and they're better able to stay safe and comfortable even as the climate warms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Portland commuters may experience temporary delays over the coming weeks due to the filming of a movie. The Night Always Comes stars Vanessa Kirby and is an adaptation of Oregon author Willie Vlauten's novel of the same name. Kirby recently received an Oscar nomination for Pieces of a Woman. The Night Always Comes depicts a working-class Portlander fighting for financial stability. Vlauten's novels Lean on Pete and The Motel Life have also been adapted into films. The book is set in a Portland landscape rapidly changing due to gentrification. Portlanders traveling across the Broadway Bridge today can expect 3 to 5 minute delays from 6 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. Similar delays are expected tomorrow on the Burnside Bridge between 1 and 3:30 p.m., as well as on Friday, June 12th, on the Hawthorne Bridge between 2 and 5 a.m. All sidewalks are expected to remain open during filming. You're listening to Spring Membership Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 21st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Reed Johnson and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Jill Freitas, Catherine Carley, Eric Galatas, Alex Gonzalez, Mike Moen, and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go online to bit.ly/KBOO or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Reed Johnson. Documents revealed in April by U.S. Right to Know under Freedom of Information Act legislation have added more evidence to the suggestion that there was an attempt to assemble viruses similar to COVID-19. Initially, all we heard was that the coronavirus was caused by human contact with animals in a wet market in Wuhan, China. But some were skeptical of that theory and thought the virus came from an accidental leak from a bioweapons lab in Wuhan. And then some researchers concluded that the virus originated among miners in Mojiang, China. Jonathan Latham is a virologist and plant biologist and the executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
It sounds like the theory of COVID has evolved over the years. At first, there was this general idea that it was transmitted by bats and at a Chinese food market. And then there were people who said, no, it was an accidental leap at the Wuhan lab. And then you were talking about the miners' theory. So where is it at now? Is there a new consensus or is there still serious debate about the origins of the virus?
Well, I would say that there is still a serious debate among people who think it leaked from the lab as to exactly what kind of a leak that it was. I would say that anybody who says it did not leak from the lab is arguing in bad faith. I mean, at the present time, there's such a mountain of evidence in favor of some form of escape from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. You can't really escape discussing that. You know, people, it's illegitimate to have doubts. I think all of us, you know, any sensible person leaves room for doubt in all these questions. But what certain virologists have been saying all along is that undoubtedly it was a zoonosis, and that is clearly a bad faith argument at this point. The discussion, I would say, at the moment is more about whether the virus was engineered and also escaped, right? So was, for example, the furin cleavage site added on purpose, or was it what we believe, which is that it had actually evolved in a sense naturally, but inside people who are hospitalized and whose samples were collected by the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So those would be the minors.
So what about people like Anthony Fauci? He was kind of against the lab leak theory, at least publicly. Has his position shifted at all?
Well, I mean, he's occasionally allowed some room in his public statements for the possibility that it might have been a lab leak. But, you know, behind the scenes, he's done two things. One, he has done his level best to squelch any discussion of the lab leak theory. But at the same time, discussions that he's been involved in have accepted that there's a very high probability that there really was a lab leak. So he's then played rather a complex game in all this.
Some people don't want the lab leak story to get much play because they're afraid of more tensions with China. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I mean, it makes no, you know, in a sense, if your concern is racism or national anti-Chinese nationalism, for example, it really doesn't matter that much if the virus escaped from a seafood market as a result of hunting or farming activities that were shouldn't have been going on, versus lab activities that shouldn't have been going on. So, you know, when people say that the lab leak theory is racist or nationalistic or anti-Chinese, it's unclear what they actually mean by that, but that concept has been bandied around endlessly, and to me, to my puzzlement, really.
It seems like in some cases, it's not that they really object to the theory, it's that they think that certain forces in society and in the political world will take advantage of it to create a kind of racist trope about it.
There is that possibility, right? There are people who want to do that. But to me, as a scientist, it's more important to get to the truth. And if you get to the truth, then there's less possibility for people to manufacture a fictional story that's to their liking that may end up serving those kind of powerful people even more. And that's the worst concern for me.
If you had to lay out what you think really happened, what would you say?
Well, I would bet my house that what happened was that there was an outbreak of a novel coronavirus in 2012, that it happened inside the six miners who had COVID-19 type symptoms, that virus evolved inside them, and that their samples were harvested by the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So all of this is basically known. And then they took those samples and they attempted to do some what's called reverse genetics. The reverse genetics is basically where you take an RNA virus that, in order to be kept alive in the lab and studied, needs to be cultured. They turned it into basically a DNA form of itself that could be stored in the freezer relatively safely, but also less safely be manipulated. An RNA virus is a very long genome and hard to manipulate. A DNA virus is the same size, but we have all the tools, the enzymes and so forth, to manipulate genomes made of DNA. And so that's essentially what was being done. Either it was being cloned simply in order to study the live virus, or it was being cloned and reverse engineered in order to do more complicated studies like swapping around bits of viruses and making hybrid viruses. But something along those lines was being attempted by the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And the reason why we think we know that is because there are hallmarks of reverse engineering in the genome of that virus. And there was a grant proposal to create those hallmarks of reverse engineering in a virus like SARS-2. So this is what I mean by a mountain of evidence. You got a grant proposal that was proposing to do it, and a virus that looks like it was done.
As far as you can tell, has all this research, is this leading scientists to the point where they can actually block these kind of viruses or deal with them in a much more effective way?
Well, I mean, in the case of a virus isolated from these miners, what you've done is makes, you know, provided the selection environment for a perfection of a human infecting lung virus. So, you know, that is unprecedented. And what would be the defense against that kind of thing is a little difficult to be sure, because, you know, vaccines have been a modest defense at best, I would say. Some scientists think there are no signs of vaccine efficacy in the population. And, you know, others argue that vaccines were moderately effective, but it's clear that vaccines didn't protect the whole population. And they can be made on a case-by-case basis, but they can be made in a hurry if you cut corners and don't do the testing. That is, you know, the virus spreads around the world in 6 or 8 weeks, you know, new variants appear. And that's far quicker, even with RNA vaccines, than we can make and test them. So at the moment, we don't really have the tools to protect against these kinds of viruses. But what the minor theory shows is a blueprint, if you like, by which basically any bat virus can be taken from the wild and turned into a pandemic virus. And that's a concern, obviously.
Would you say that a virus of this, of the scale of COVID, could come soon or at any time?
You know, the problem is that the pandemic has led to a proliferation of high security BSL-4 type labs of the kind that was in Wuhan that spilled the virus in the first place. And if you don't believe that this research leads to safer viruses, and there's not much evidence that it does, we learn things, but we don't necessarily learn how to fix pandemics. But at the same time, if these labs are going to proliferate and people are going to do more experiments and more creative experiments with these novel viruses, we're cooking up a problem all of its own.
How truthful do you think the health authorities have been in the U.S. with the public about the virus?
Well, in terms of the origin, not truthful in the least. I mean, there's an email of Christian Anderson, who is a Fauci confidant, saying that an engineered virus was so freaking likely, quote unquote. And yet that none of that has come out from the interviews with Congress and explained to the media and so on and so forth. So the real thinking that was going on behind the scenes among high officials and Tony Fauci and his colleagues is really not been reflected in what's been explained to the U.S. public. But somehow or other, the truth, you know, through Twitter and a few other sources, the truth has sort of leaked out anyways, you know, in a slightly half-assed way.
Other than their public statements on the origins of the virus, did you think they handled the crisis fairly well, or was their response inadequate?
I mean, it's easy to say they didn't handle it well retrospectively, you know, but at the time, you know, we knew very little about this virus and what treatments were likely to be effective. You know, every new virus that comes along is basically a little bit of a blank sheet. You know, you can draw some potential lessons from previous viruses, but you can also be concerned that each new virus is different from the one that came before. You know, they can have, you know, subtle differences in the virus genome can lead to big differences in the tissue specificity of the virus, in the pathogenicity of the virus, in the spread of the virus. I mean, SARS-1 and SARS-2 are really very similar viruses to each other, but they had completely different outcomes in terms of, you know, SARS-2 basically was very, very harmful, SARS-1 was much more harmful than SARS-2, but it died out as a pathogenic virus. It was eliminated. Whereas SARS-2 is less harmful, but it's persisting in the population and has nevertheless killed many more people ultimately than SARS-1 did.
It seems like we were hearing about mutations for a while, and now we don't hear so much about them, at least as far as the lay public goes. So what's going on there? Has the virus...
I mean, I've a little bit had my head down, you know, doing some research and hopefully going to publish something about our theory soon. But the issue is that, you know, we've had these new variants that have taken scientists by surprise. You know, the Omicron virus, for example, evolved inside a single person, right? So this one virus, it basically evolved more to be more virulent and more successful than all the viruses and all the other people in the entire rest of the world. So you've got 5 billion people infected with COVID during the time that Omicron was evolving inside a single person, and yet the virus that ends up being the most successful one is Omicron. And so this is a situation that took virologists by surprise. And so it's really hard to rule out future surprises too.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
You know, the question you ask about, you know, is there going to be a scientific consensus? You know, I went to a virology meeting, well, three virology meetings last summer. And in each one of them, the consensus among the virologists was that they didn't know anything about the origin of the virus. And it was simply because they all understood that if they looked into this subject, it would probably be bad for their careers. And so they would just look the other way, right? Because you basically got a media consensus that it came from the Hunan seafood market. And then you got people who actually asked questions who found that story very, very difficult to believe. And so they didn't want to join those ranks of people who found it very, very difficult to believe, because they're now being, those people who remain on social media and so forth are being isolated and threatened. You know, the latest threat was two researchers from Biosafety Now had letters written to their universities, so public letters written to their universities that were made public and published in Science magazine, basically arguing that they had violated freedom of speech policies of their universities, with the implication that they should be fired.
They violated free speech provisions by speaking out? How did that work?
It's absurd. I mean, basically because they pointed out that the people who leaked the virus had killed a lot of people, and that we need to know the answer to this. And that was essentially, I mean, there's a set of false accusations that are being made against them by people who've been extraordinary bullies online, you know, saying really outrageous and totally unreasonable things, and yet who present themselves as the bullied. But it's absolutely backwards.
But you're with an organization that has some independence, and you don't have to worry about that kind of pressure, is that right?
Well, nobody can fire me because we run a nonprofit. I mean, we could be shut down by the social media organizations, and Facebook doesn't share our material anymore. It's very difficult. We can share material on Twitter, but that's pretty much the only platform. Many of the outlets that I used to write for and that would reproduce our material no longer do that, simply because they don't accept that COVID could possibly have come from a lab, even though they haven't investigated the facts themselves.
Maybe if we talk again, things will have shifted. Who knows?
Yeah, well, things have shifted continuously during the pandemic, especially about the origins story. So I think, you know, there's always room to hope that the truth will prevail.
That's Jonathan Latham of the Bioscience Resource Project speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. You're listening to KABU News in Depth. Stay with us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Birdie. Major U.S. corporations paid less in federal income taxes between 2018 and 2022 than they paid their top executives. That's according to a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies. David Cass is the executive director of Americans for Tax Fairness. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about the findings of the report.
So something's not fair with the way these corporate executives get paid as compared to how these companies pay their taxes. How does that happen? I mean, I guess that's sort of standard procedure now. I mean, the companies will say, well, we have to pay these people so much money because otherwise we can't attract the talent. And the other companies will get these valuable people and we will be deprived of them. Is that kind of the argument they use?
Right. And, you know, as I think President Biden said, nobody's against corporate executives getting paid, you know, at some wage. The question is just how vast a difference there should be between them and everybody else. And so we released this report where we found that there are 35 major U.S. corporations in the country, you know, names that you know, Ford, Netflix, Tesla, and they paid their top five corporate executives more than they paid in federal taxes. Now, that's pretty crazy, right? I mean, and they were all profitable over a five-year span, too. So they were making money, but they weren't paying much in taxes. And so what we found was that over this period, they paid their executives $9.5 billion with a B, but they paid actually a negative tax rate. So they got a refund of $1.8 billion. So they paid their corporate executives $9.5 billion, and they got a refund from the government for $1.8 billion.
So is this unprecedented in the history of U.S. corporate taxation, or is this something new?
So things absolutely have been getting worse. That, you know, the effective corporate tax rate has been going down for a long time. And, you know, we found that it's not just these 35 corporations, though, that we found that there are an additional 29 corporations that were profitable, and they paid their corporate executives more than they paid in taxes in two of the 5 years. And listen to this, in 18 corporations, they were profitable over the five-year period, but they paid $0 in federal income taxes. And so their effective tax rate was 2.8%. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd be happy to pay just a couple percent on my income. You know, why are these big, profitable, wealthy corporations paying so little in taxes?
How do they do it? Is it just tax loopholes? How would you explain that?
One of the things that happened was in 2017, the Trump tax cut was changed, and it dramatically lowered the tax rate in corporations. It was 35%, and they dropped it to 21%. So a 40% drop, right? So that's a big piece of it. And then there are all these loopholes. And you know, that's why we're saying that corporations should pay their fair share of taxes, because it affects everybody, right? When there's not enough, when corporations aren't paying their taxes, there's not enough money to fund defense, to fund education, to fund housing. It has a direct impact on every American. So, you know, and so I think President Biden in his budget called for raising taxes on corporations. It was an important call. And so, you know, we're supporting these changes.
There was a time back in the 50s during the Eisenhower administration where the, I guess you would call it the personal tax rate for super rich people was 91%. What was the corporate tax rate at that time? Do you happen to know?
You know, I'd have to double check exactly for that year, but yes, it was much higher than it is now, and it has kept going down. And so let me just give you an example of how things are now. So let's just take Tesla, for example. So over the last 5 years, their executives were paid $2.5 billion. They made $4.4 billion in profit. That's what their income tax was, minus $1 million. So they paid less than zero. You know, they're the eighth most valuable corporation in the world as at least the end of last year. They're worth $800 billion. It's run by one of the wealthiest people in the world, Elon Musk. And despite all that wealth, they've never paid a nickel in federal income taxes. You know, that doesn't make any sense.
I remember during the Greek economic crisis of a few years ago, one of the comments or one of the criticisms about what was going on there was that rich people didn't pay their taxes. Is it as bad here as it was there? Or I don't know, has anyone done a comparative study of how the U.S. ranks in terms of corporate tax cheating or whatever you want to call it?
Well, it is certainly true that over the last decade, the IRS has been, their budget has been cut dramatically by Republicans. And the impact has been that, you know, if you don't have, corporations have pretty complicated tax returns. You need people at the IRS who really know what's going on so can dig into it. And the IRS hasn't had enough people. Fortunately, in 2022, Democrats passed this big additional money for the IRA, for the IRS. And that's starting to pay off already. So, you know, there's the wait times that for customers to call the IRS has gone down, but also they're able to go after corporate tax cheats. Because, you know, our message is just like, if you owe taxes, you got to pay them. Just like you and me, like we all have to pay it. That's the law. Why should corporations be any different?
Okay, so the IRS has lost people. Does that mean they don't do audits on these corporations?
Right, so the audits have dropped dramatically over the last decade. And so I think that this additional funding that's going to the IRS is really helpful to go after tax cheats, right? Everybody wants people, if you owe money, you should pay it. But if you know that there's nobody who's going to come after you, there's an incentive to cheat. So, you know, we need the funding of the IRS to make sure that corporations and wealthy individuals, you know, the super wealthy pay their taxes.
And in terms of the executive salaries, is there a kind of cultural problem there that somehow the idea is so prevalent that these people need to be paid these exorbitant salaries? I mean, why are they considered so valuable when it's really the people under them that do so much of the work?
Now, corporate CEOs are being paid, you know, 300 times more than the average worker. And it used to be much, much less than that. So absolutely, it is. And you know, as President Biden said in the State of the Union speech, you know, look, we're not against paying it. It's just the government shouldn't subsidize, shouldn't get a tax break for, you know, paying more than $1 million. Like, you want to pay more than that, your corporation, you can do that. But you shouldn't get a tax break for doing that.
Well, Biden, you know, he was the senator from Delaware. That's a big corporate state where companies go to get better breaks. And he kind of carried water for them for years, right? Why do you think he's kind of shifting here? Or is he? Or is this just too outrageous that even someone like Biden has to say something?
Well, you know, I think the proof is in the pudding. There were very specific proposals in his budget that he released, and which, you know, would raise taxes on raise the corporate tax rate, say that, you know, if you pay your executives more than $1 million, you don't get a subsidy. So I think there's some really important policies that would rein in some of these loopholes.
And was there or were there any moves in Congress in recent years to do those kind of things? I mean, before he made this.
Yeah. So I think one of the important steps that Democrats took when they were in control in 2022 was they said that corporations have to pay a minimum tax of 15%. And I think that's really important, right? So that in 2020, there were 55 corporations, big corporations, that paid zero in taxes. If you're a big profitable corporation, why are you paying zero in taxes? So there should be a minimum tax rate. So I think that's a really important step forward. The Democrats were able to pass this 15% for minimum income tax.
Are you optimistic that some new legislation will get passed to deal with this problem?
Well, it's an election year. I don't know how much will get passed in divided government this year. But I think one of the important things is that next year, a lot of these Trump tax cuts expire. That's the way the Republicans set them up to try to make them seem like they don't cost as much. And so there will be a big fight over that. So we're saying, you know, these Trump tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy, they should not be extended and certainly shouldn't be extended for people making more than $400,000 a year. The rich corporations, they don't need more tax cuts. They have enough. You know, we should really be instead raising taxes on the rich and corporations and investing in everyday Americans, you know, in education, healthcare, and all the things that families need to thrive.
So if the tax rate before the Trump cuts was 35% and Trump lowered it to 21% and Biden, what does he want, 28%?
Right.
Was that sort of him saying, well, let's compromise? Or do you know the logic of that?
I mean, perhaps. We'd like it, obviously, to go as close back up to 35% as possible. Corporations seem to still be pretty profitable with a 35% tax rate. But, you know, we need to take steps to raise it. Absolutely.
Anything else you want to add?
You know, I think that the big thing, and so just to say, we did this report with the Institute for Policy Studies, and we used data from one of our partners from ITEP and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. And, you know, I think what this shows is that, you know, we need to have more policies so that the corporate America is paying their fair share in taxes. And, you know, we shouldn't have big, wealthy, profitable corporations paying their executives more than they're paying in taxes.
Yeah, I wonder if anyone will propose a law banning or putting a limit on how much executives can be paid, you know, not 300 times as much, maybe just 10 times as much. I guess that would be too, in the corporate world, that would be considered outrageous.
You know, it is certainly something that we need to make sure that corporations are paying their fair share. There's certainly a lot of ways to do that.
That was David Kass of Americans for Tax Fairness speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Birdie. Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO.